Writer Peggy Orenstein has a 12-year-old daughter, and she started hearing stories from other parents, stories about sexting, about binge drinking, about how their kids would hook up to have sex and then not talk to each other again. The end result of those stories is her new book called Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. Peggy Orenstein told KUOW's Jeannie Yandel she almost decided she didn't want to hear those stories at all, and then she realized she had to hear them and she needed to hear them firsthand.
Parenting from ignorance and fear is always a good strategy, so I decided that probably wasn't the best idea. And meanwhile, all that was going on, and we were having this umbrella conversation in the culture about assault on campus, which, you know, has burst forward again with the Stanford case, and consent, and that was so important. And yet I also felt that it really should be the beginning of a conversation rather than the end point, you know, consent, and that I really wanted to know what was happening for girls after yes, and, you know, what we needed to do as a culture to make that experience the best it could be for them.
Well, you talked with 70 girls from middle school age to college age. How did you get them to talk to you about this? I'm trying to imagine what those conversations were like. How did you even get them to open up?
It was so not hard. It was so not hard. You know, I shouldn't say that. The first couple of interviews I did were awful because they would talk to me and I was kind of shocked by what they were saying and I betrayed that in my face. And those were the only two girls that I spoke with who would never respond to me again when I would, you know, text them or email them or try all the 5,000 different ways we get in touch now. But with most of the girls, with many of them, I am regularly in touch. And the fact was what they would say to me is, nobody's ever asked me these questions. Nobody's ever talked to me about this. I've never had the opportunity to reflect on my personal life. And they would write to me later and say, you know, because of our conversation, I've changed my major. Because of our conversation, I've really thought about this relationship I'm in. Because of our conversation, I've really thought about what hookups mean to me. I mean, the conversations ended up being transformative for them as well as for me. And they were really, really, I mean, even if I had never written the book, they were some of the most meaningful conversations I've had with people.
Why?
Well, just because the girls were so willing to be honest, were so willing to go deep, were so willing to reflect on who they were, and it became so apparent to me as I spoke to them that we have kind of placed planet sex in this other solar system from everything else that we talk about with young women. So, you know, the young women that I spoke with, as you said, they were actually more like 15 to 20, so more like high school and college, and they were such bright girls. They were all college-bound or in college, and I chose that demographic because I really wanted to talk to the girls that we think of as having the most opportunity and being, you know, the primary beneficiaries of the feminist movement. And yet there was this disconnect between all of that. They were leaning in everywhere in their educational lives and their professional goals and all of that, but toppling in their personal lives. And one of the girls said to me, I come from generations of strong women. My grandma was a firecracker, and my mom is a professional, and she's so smart, and my sister and I are really loud, and that's our form of feminine power. But then she detailed her sex life to me, and it was kind of a series. She was 20 and an Ivy League college student, and she said, you know, it was a series of one-off kind of hookups that weren't very satisfying or reciprocal or enjoyable, and she said, I guess, you know, we girls are just socialized to be deferential and not express our wants and needs. And I said, but what happened to that strong woman? She said, well, nobody ever told me that strong woman image applied to sex. So there was this real disconnect among the girls that was really poignant to hear.
You said the first couple of girls you talked to, what you heard was kind of shocking and you betrayed that in your face. Why was it shocking?
You know, what surprised me was what I did know I would be talking about were, you know, ideas about the media and about the selling of hot to girls and the impact of self-objectification. What surprised me was the lack of pleasure and the lack of reciprocity and their acceptance of that. And, I mean, I came to a number of conclusions about why they felt that way. One was about their... Girls felt shame around their own genitals. They would talk about them at once as, you know, like being combination of sacred and icky. And I really came to believe that part of that was that we had performed what I called the psychological clitoridectomy on American girls. And what I mean by that is that, you know, when we have our children, when we have our infants, we tend to name all the parts on a baby boy's body. At least we'll say, there's your pee-pee, you know, something. Mm-hmm. But with girls, we go right from navel to knees. And that leaves that whole, you know, situation in there unspeakable. And then they get to puberty education class, and they learn that boys have erections and ejaculations, and girls have periods and unwanted pregnancy. And you only see that internal diagram that looks kind of like a steer's head, you know, the one I mean, right? And yes. Then it kind of grays, right? Then it grays out between the legs. So we never say labia. We never say clitoris. And no surprise, fewer than half of teenage girls have ever masturbated. And then they go into their partnered interactions. And we somehow expect that they're going to have a voice, that they're going to have some sense of equality, that they can, you know, we have set them up. They can't articulate their needs and wants because they have no idea what those might be. And we have to ask who is entitled to engage in an experience. And the girls did feel entitled to engage. But then you get to the other questions. Who's entitled to enjoy the experience? Who's the primary beneficiary of the experience? And how each partner defines good enough? Mm. And I honestly think those are hard questions for us as adult women. And if we ask them, there's a lot of reckoning to be done. But when we're talking about girls, I just kept coming back to this idea that those early foundational experiences should not be something they have to get over.
What does consent even look like? How did these girls talk about their understanding of consent and what that means in a situation where they feel like they can engage, but enjoyment is something they don't really feel like they're entitled to?
I mean, that was one thing that I felt, as I said, I was looking at what happens after yes, and that, it was really clear to me, played into what's happening on campuses. Because even if you think about, like, I was in a classroom towards the end that was a co-educational classroom where kids were really trying to work these ideas out together. And one of the boys raised his hand, and he said, you know that baseball metaphor? You know, the one that we all learn, right? I mean, every American knows that baseball metaphor for sex, you know, rounding the bases towards home, right? And he said, in baseball, there's winners and there's losers. So who's the loser supposed to be in sex? And really, in that metaphor, I think girls are the field. They're not even the opposing team. They're the field on which the game is played. And the way that we teach kids about sex, it embeds coercion into the process. And girls' limits are seen as a challenge. And when we're talking about heterosexual sex, girls' limits are seen as a challenge for boys to overcome. And that promotes this idea. I mean, I heard a lot of girls did tell me about assault. And honestly, it wasn't something that was that much on my radar when I started the work. This conversation hadn't really burst onto the scene yet. I wasn't surprised by it, but, you know, obviously it was really hard to hear. But what was equally hard, and sometimes even more hard to hear, were these garden variety stories from nearly all the girls that involved being pushed past their limits, that involved coercion, that involved alcohol, that involved all of these things that reduced their ability or confounded their ability to be able to say what they wanted, know what they wanted, feel what they wanted. Are you there?
Yeah, no, I'm here. It's I'm quiet because that's a very difficult thing to hear.
It is really hard. And I would go back. I mean, I haven't talked about this a lot because I've really resisted having interviews be overtaken by discussions of assault because that wasn't really what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about this other piece. And I do feel really strongly that by helping girls and boys understand the role of and the existence of female pleasure in the sexual equation, we will level I hate to say the playing field because I'm staying in that metaphor, but we will shift that conversation a little bit. I do really think that's part of it. But I would go back to, I mean, I did the work all over the country, so I was often staying in hotels, and I would go back to my hotel room and, you know, just leave the lights on and lay on the bed and, you know, just sort of have to sit there with what I'd heard and what I was bearing witness to and let it, you know, kind of absorb, because a lot of times the interviews were really, really tough, even as they were gratifying and important. They were hard.
what do you do with that information? I mean, with that body of information that girls have these kind of, as you said, garden variety stories about being assaulted, about being harassed, what's the way forward? How do you fix a problem like this?
You know, we have had just abysmal sex education in our country for decades now, and this is one of the results of that, frankly. And when we look at comparisons with other countries, I mean, even in that Stanford case, I don't think it was an accident that the two people who stepped in, chased the rapist down and tackled him and held him until the cops came, were Swedish. They were not Americans. It was two Swedish graduate students. And one of them was so distraught by what had happened that he was sobbing too hard to talk to the police initially. And one of the things that I did was compare Holland to the U.S. because we have data on how Dutch college women talk about their early sexual experience versus American college women. And in every outcome, whether you're talking about fewer negative outcomes like disease, pregnancy, regret, drunkenness, or more positive outcomes like knowing your partner very well, being able to say what you want and don't want, preparing responsibly, having a good time, having a positive body image, all of those things, the Dutch girls come out ahead. And what they said was that from a very young age, parents, teachers, and doctors all talked to Dutch kids really clearly and openly about their expectations and the realities and explicitly around sexuality. And one of the really big differences that struck me as a parent was that while American parents are not necessarily less comfortable talking to their kids about sex, we generally only emphasize risk and danger. And Dutch parents talk about balancing responsibility and joy. And that is such a paradigm shift, because I know that had I not done this work, I would have talked to my daughter about contraception. I would have talked to her about disease protection. And because I'm very modern, I would have talked to her about consent. And I would have thought that I'd done my job. I would have thought I'd done a great job. And now I know that's really only half the conversation.
Peggy Orenstein wrote the book Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. You're listening to KUOW's The Record.